Okay, what we do here Monday night is Jewish history. And we are right now in the period at the end of the 17th century, beginning of the 18th century. We actually haven't finished the 17th century yet. And just to review what happened in the 1600s in the Jewish world, very quickly, in the early 1600s we had great scholars such as the Maharal, the Rabbi of Prague, Reb Lowy of Prague, who wrote many works of very profound scholarship on Jewish thought. He was also coming in the wake of the Ari, the great cabalist of the 16th century, who started revealing much greater aspects of Jewish thought than had ever been revealed before. And this became a very, very mystical age, because there was lots of Kabbalah going around and lots of deep Jewish thought about other things going around. So what happened was that 1648, there was a massive pogrom led by Khmelnytsky in the Ukraine and in Poland, and together with this mystical bent and together with the great persecution which occurred, there was a very heavy messianic movement at the time. In other words, people were anticipating that the Messiah would come very shortly because things, A, we knew lots of many more Kabbalistic things, or B, or they're more exposed, I should say, people became aware of them. B, also, there was such terrible persecution. So what could come next? What had to come next, it would seem, would be the redemption. And a figure stepped into that breach and appointed himself the Messiah. And that person was Shabtai Tzvi. Shabtai Tzvi was the greatest false messiah in Jewish history. He managed to hoodwink a majority of the Jews of his time into believing that he was the Messiah. He did many, many things which are controversial, and still people did not lose faith in him. He did not keep kosher. He abolished certain fast days. He made new holidays. And yet people continued to believe in him as the Messiah until such time as he actually converted to Islam. Whoa. When he converted to Islam in the 1660s, the Sultan basically gave him a choice. The Sultan of the Ottoman Empire said, convert or die, and Shabtai Tzvi chose the former alternative. So he converted to Islam, and that basically was the beginning of the end of his movement. But it wasn't the end. Now I'm going to jump ahead and then jump back. There is, to this very day, we don't know to what extent, a subgroup in Turkey called the Donme. The Donme are the followers of Shabtai Tzvi. They exist to this day. As a matter of fact, in Turkish anti-Semitic literature, they very often accuse the founders of modern Turkey, who did away with much of the trappings of Islam. Turkey was a very, at least for most of its existence since the death of the Ottoman Empire, is a very secular nation. So they attribute that to leaders who really came from Donme origins. The Donme were, again, Jews who followed Shabtai Tzvi. After Shabtai Tzvi converted to Islam, and certainly after his death, they retained less and less connection to Judaism. Finally, they had no connection at all, but they weren't Muslims either. So they're kind of crypto Shabtai Tzvi followers. They didn't actually celebrate their rituals in public, but they kept that tradition alive. We don't know how many there are today. We don't know if they're active today, but there is that claim that Atatürk and the other founders of modern Turkey were descendants of the Donme. Now, these Donme retained their belief in Shabtai Tzvi as a holy figure even after his death. It's hard for us to conceive of, but this actually was not just in Turkey and not just those followers. For many years throughout the world, there were reverberations of Sabbatean thought well into the 18th, even to the end of the 18th century. Now, I'm going to come back to that in a few moments. First, I want to talk about what was so attractive about Shabtai Tzvi. Sabbath Tzvi really made had a very sensual religion. There was a lot of licentious behavior was encouraged. Loose morals were the basics to being a Sabbatean, and it was all in the name of a mystical approach. In other words, the mysticism of Sabbatai Tzvi was one which entailed license to do all sorts of things which had previously not been permitted under the guise of holiness. So that actually became, he actually made a blessing. Blessed is God, blessed are you, God our Lord, who allows us to permit that which was forbidden. So we have a blessing like that, one of the blessings which you make in the morning, Matir Asurim, that our God releases those who are captive. And it's supposed to be a metaphor for he lets you get out of bed in the morning. If you're a captive in bed, you get out of bed, you're able to walk around, but it's a very easy play on the words. You get Matir Isurim, that God allows us to permit that which is forbidden. So that was very attractive. And his followers followed in that path, and it culminated in the sect of Polish Jews. Sapetsi was a Sfardi. He lived most of his life in Turkey. He had most of his disciples were Sfardi Jews, although he also captured a large portion of Ashkenazi Jews. But later on, in the 1720s, through the 1790s, there arose a sect called the Frankists. The Frankists were led by a neo-Sabbatean, meaning somebody who follows Sabbatai Tzvi's perspective. His name was Jacob Frank, and he was a very, I guess, charismatic type of person who also used licentious behavior as an attraction, and he had this sect in Poland where they actually, again, used Kabbalah in a very sensual a sexual way. Now, Kabbalah lends itself to this. But how does it lend itself to this? Because lots of the metaphors in Kabbalah, in the Kabbalistic literature, have to do with unions. And the archetype for a union is the union between a husband and wife, between a man and a woman. And therefore, there is a lot of material in Kabbalah which you, not anybody in this room, but which people would be might well use in a way which in which they can justify very, very sexual and illicit behavior as a manifestation of, in the physical world, of the supernal unions which are discussed in Kabbalistic literature. So that's what Frank was about, and Frank actually, eventually, he followed the footsteps of Sabbatai Tzvi, only he didn't become a Muslim, he became a Christian. He and his followers began to Christianity, and they disappeared from the scene, but only very, very late, in the late 1700s. Generally speaking, however, there was, besides these Domet and the Frankists, which were obviously overt or covert, but separatist movements, Sabbatai Tzvi's influence, and it's hard for us to understand this today, but remained strong in mainstream Judaism. Meaning that mainstream Judaism had rabbis, had great scholars, who remained sympathetic to the Sabbatean system of Kabbalah, even after Sabbatai Tzvi disappeared from the scene. Now, I can't tell you exactly how it manifests itself, because I don't know enough about amulets. But it all had to do with how certain amulets were written, whether they used Lurianic Kabbalah, or whether you use Sabbatean Kabbalah. In other words, what were the amulet is like a small piece of parchment which inscribes various different words and formulas. Or were they, what kind of Kabbalah was used on that amulet? Yeah.
Is there anything that's filtered into today that's like Neo-Sabbatean that came into current or modern?
I don't think so. I don't think to this day we have any of it. But there was in the 1700s, it was still very much an issue. Yeah.
What is Sabbatean Kabbalah?
It's a very much more sexually based, much more explicitly sexual. It substitutes Sabbatai Tzvi himself for.
Kero something which is Kabbalah.
Oh yeah. Kabbalah is a very cool thing. You know, you could look. You know, Madonna likes Kabbalah too. So so you can use Kabbalah and abuse Kabbalah in wonderful ways.
the Frankish, did you say that he then became a Arabian? You know, thought that maybe he was the Messiah?
Yes.
Okay. So now, when he became Christian, was this used by the church at all?
Right.
Yes, for anything?
The church, he told the church he would persuade the Jews to come over to the church. He wasn't so successful.
No, was he even trying?
I don't know if he did try. I don't know if he made a massive effort. But he justified going to the church. He, as a success of the Shabtai Tzvi, this time Shabtai Tzvi had to go to the depth of Tumah, of impurity, another religion, in order to uplift them to the Messianic Age. He also had to go to the depth of impurity in order to uplift the Christians into the Messianic Age. So that was how he justified it. So what happened was that in the late 1600s, early 1700s, there was a very, very big backlash against Kabbalah. There was another big backlash at the time, not so big, against Spinoza. Spinoza was a member of the Jewish community in Amsterdam, who in the mid to late 1600s became a great philosopher, and he's famous for becoming a pantheist, meaning that he equated God with the natural forces in the world. And later on, we're going to see, I don't know if it is tonight, that Hasidim were accused of being pantheists as well, as if they're following in the pathways of Spinoza almost. But Spinoza was excommunicated by the community in Amsterdam in the 1650s, and he was one of those rare Jews who actually was completely excluded from the Jewish community. And although to the entire world Spinoza is one of the great philosophers of all time, to the Jewish community he is an anathema, because he was not willing to accept any tradition, but rather decided that he had to determine everything on his own from scratch. So there was, until that time, the 1600s or so, there was a lot of tendency among Jews, to the rabbis, learned scholars, to study philosophy, the ancient Greek philosophy. Socrates, Aristotle, Plato, actually, whatever those Socrates comes from Plato, so Aristotle, Plato, etc., etc. But now, there was a big backlash against philosophy. Philosophy was, there had been a backlash earlier, in the 1100s, or 1200s, I'm sorry, 1200s after Maimonides, after the Rambam, because he was big into philosophy, and a lot of people didn't like that, and there was a backlash. But then the matter was quiet for many years until this time when, again, there was a backlash against philosophy because now it was moving in new and dangerous directions which hitherto had not been a problem. But that's a relatively minor aspect of Spinoza controversy. The major issue was Kabbalah. So you will find in the halachic works which are written at this time, warnings, and this includes the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch, the basic book of Jewish law, that you should not study Kabbalah until you are 40 years old and you have finished all of the Talmud and you are married. That way, you're old enough that your first impulses have somewhat quieted down. B, you're married, so therefore that takes also care of some of the other impulses which Kabbalah might bring up in your mind. And C, if you're a very learned scholar, then it also diminishes the amount of improper fantasy you might have as a result of studying certain Kabbalistic texts. So that all being said, this ban until 40 has almost never been kept, even though it's on the books. Really, shortly after the ban was issued, the Hasidim came up on the stage, and they learned Kabbalah from a very, very early age. Yeah.
But shouldn't years ago a rabbi told me that I should not personally have anything to do with Kabbalah until I had learned the Torah, Talmud. Much more than I have. I mean,
I don't agree. It's there's a lot of
nobody else did, but
yeah. there's a lot of things one can get. The type of Kabbalah which is a problem is not Kabbalah which you're going to have access to in the initial stages of studying it. It's way advanced. So it's not an issue for us. You know, whatever Kabbalistic work we generally pick up off the shelf, it's not that kind of Kabbalah which they were talking about. They're talking about much more esoteric stuff. So one of the people who suffered to a great an example as a result of this backlash against Kabbalah and against mysticism was one of the famous Jewish thinkers, most famous Jewish thinkers of all time, Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto. Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto was an Italian rabbi. Luzzatto was an Italian Jewish name, and he was born in 1707, and he passed away in a cholera epidemic in Israel in 1747, which means he passed away when he was 40. But he was learning Kabbalah from the time he was a young man, very young man, and he claimed to have communication with the higher realms. He claimed to have communication with the angels, with departed souls. And he wrote books which are have very heavy Kabbalistic content. And he was a great writer. He wrote very lucid, very clear. And his works became very popular. So he was the subject of one of these major backlashes. And he had to, under pain of excommunication, except not to publish any of his Kabbalistic works until he was 40. So remain in hiding. So one book he did publish a couple of books. The main book which he published in his lifetime has become one of the great Jewish classics, which is the Mesirat Yesharim. Mesirat Yesharim, The Path of the Just, is a book about how to be a good Jew in the sense not of just halacha, of Jewish law, but also in the sense of being an ethical and holy person. People don't necessarily realize it, but the point of the book is how to become a prophet in 10 very hard steps. In other words, it tells you how you go up the ladder from the base all the way until you can have prophetic experiences.
How?
You have to read the book.
It's
a very hard book to read. It's very hard for me to get past the first chapter because when am I ever going to get past the first chapter? I think it's a very depressing book, actually. But that's what it's meant for. It was meant as a guide to how to achieve Ruach HaKodesh, how to achieve divine spirit. And Ramchal said to have how to achieve that. And from the books, most of which were published after his death, because, again, till 40 he wasn't allowed to publish his Kabbalistic works. Most of the works are full of amazing Kabbalistic insights, fascinating stuff, some of which is easier, some of which is a lot harder, but the Ramchal has become, in recent years, one of the major sources of Jewish thinking. Now, I want to tell you, there are certain people after their death, their reputation suffered. Not necessarily because they deserved it, it's the way the world went. There are certain people after their death, their reputation grew. Okay, not necessarily because they deserved it, but that's the way the world went. The Ramchal was always held in Eastern European circles in kind of some semi-respectful, semi-disrespectful attitude. That's because the Lithuanian Jews, the Litvaks, they didn't think the Italian Jews really knew how to learn. That they didn't know exactly how to, learn the Shas, how to learn Talmud in the proper way. They weren't learned enough. Besides that, most of them were clean-shaven. So therefore, and a lot of them went to universities. All of this, the Ramchal himself was a playwright. He wrote romantic plays. That's how he made a living. As a matter of fact, the Tel Aviv municipality once upon a time, when it wanted to institute a prize for the best play of the year, every year, called it the Ramchal Prize. I don't know if they actually went through with it, but there was a strong inclination to do that. So therefore, in yeshivas, if you look at the literature through the years, they used to call him Luzzatto. They didn't call him Ramchal. They didn't call him Reb Moshe Chaim. They called him Luzzatto. So later on it became changed to Hachati Luzzatto. but still not, you know, the rabbi Lufthansa. So and as time goes by, though, Ram Chal's reputation continues to grow. And today, people will not go around calling him Lufthansa. You won't find it anymore. Just 20 years ago, you would have found that. Yeah.
You say that he had a photographic memory and that he understood, he learned the old Talmud by his 11th year of life. And that's how he compiled his inspiration.
Mm-hmm. It's quite possible.
It's very, yeah.
Yeah.
He was not, and a lot of the great rabbis were afraid of him because his understanding was.
I'm sure he was threatening to them. Yes, absolutely.
He was threatening, but I don't think he was really a threat. I think he was just a brilliant Einstein of Jewish learning.
But people are very often misunderstood.
Yeah. I think some of the greater rabbis said that they would walk distances to study with him.
The Vilna Gaon said he would have gone.
Yeah, Vilna Gaon, yeah.
Would have gotten my foot. Vilna Gaon was only born in 1720, so they didn't overlap too much, but he said that later, when he after the Rebbe Shmuel Sharon, he would have walked to Italy to study with the Ramchal.
I don't think he could help what he was. He was exactly what he was made to be.
I agree with you.
I don't think he was competitive.
But the times were not conducive to that type of activity.
Fear.
And these workshops, I agree. Things were happening, and there were still people around. It was a very dangerous time. There's one other thing I wanted to mention about the Ramchal also. Was that he in Italy amassed groups of young people, of like-minded young people, to study together and make close-knit groups which supported each other and aided each other in their personal growth. And there are certain rules you have to meet in order to enter the group. One of the rules which always stuck in my mind more than any other rule is that anybody who joins the group has to obligate himself to devote any merit generated by any good deed that he did to the greater good of the Jewish people and not retain that merit for himself.
Wow.
Which is...
That's the greatest thing.
What?
That's the greatest
thing. Yeah, now, see, a list box would say, well, that doesn't work. You know, there's no mechanism for that to work that way. But whether it works or not, yes, it's an amazing statement. There was, what they were saying is that they're not in it for themselves, they're in it for the love of God and the betterment of the Jewish people, and therefore they will not retain any merit for themselves. It's a very powerful statement to make. So one of the enactments, but that was the one which always sticks with me as being the most salient, most powerful. So, during the time of Ramchal, several people are coming up through the ranks. Chief among them are the Baal Shem Tov and the Vilna Gaon. The Baal Shem Tov is born in 1698 or 1700, depending on which version you accept as being true, and the Vilna Gaon is born in 1720. So the Vilna Gaon was considerably younger, but they begin to be active in around the same period. Now let's start with the Baal Shem Tov. The Baal Shem Tov, Rabbi Yisroel Baal Shem Tov, a Baal Shem, is somebody who is able to use names of God to work wonders. And there have been several Baal Shem in the course of Jewish history. Any Baal Shem is supposed to be somebody who can work wonders. There have been not just authentic ones, but there have been many frauds. As a matter of fact, there is a widespread picture of the Baal Shem Tov. In fact, a drawing, painting. In fact, that painting is not a painting of the Baal Shem Tov at all. That painting is a painting of the Baal Shem of London. And he was a scoundrel. He was not a good person. And I don't know if he ended up Christian or didn't end up Christian, but he certainly was not a very nice person. So that, you can see, I think, if you look at the face, it looks like a very coarse and rough face. It doesn't look like somebody you think is ethereal and holy. So, but he called himself a Baal Shem because he knew that that was something which attracted people. So that was the Baal Shem of London. The Baal Shem Tov is called the Baal Shem Tov specifically to separated him from other Baal HaShem who may not have been as authentic and for real as he was. Now, you know that Lithuanian Jewry, to this very, you know, today basically, I'm going to make this clear, today in the Orthodox Jewish world, there are basically three faiths. There are Hasidim, there are Misnagdim, also known as Litvaks, the Lithuanians, and there are Sephardim. There's nobody else. Right? Among the Sephardim, there are certain groups also. There are Yemenites, there are North Africans, but the difference in philosophy between them is relatively small. The main philosophical groups are, again, the Hasidim, the Misnagdim, and the Sephardim. So, to this day, the Misnagdic ethos is one of intense Torah study. And intense Torah study, preferably limited as much as possible to Talmud and to Halakha, with rare digression into other areas. This was true even way back when, in the 1700s and the 1600s. And this was not adequate for the laity of the time. Till the 1600s, it seems, first of all, there weren't so many Jews. The Jewish community worldwide was very small, less than a million. But then, when the Jews started proliferating, and there were all these persecutions, and there were all these messianic and mystical tendencies, so the average Jew in his remote and isolated village, or even in his big city, who was not capable of being a learned scholar, felt kind of left out in the cold by everything. He was, the way the historians depict him, although I'm sure this is an overstatement, he was morose, depressed, dejected, and, you know, did not relate well to his Judaism. So Sonny had to fill that gap and bring these people back closer to feeling close and feeling fulfilled in Judaism. But I realize I jumped ahead of myself again. I have to go back to the Sabbateans for one more time, which is that the Sabbateans had a strain. There was a strain within the Sabbatean movement which was not into licentious behavior. I started this before and then for some reason I got off track with the annulus, we got into Kabbalah. But going back to annulus, for some reason there was a group of Jews in Western Europe and Eastern Europe who were totally observant Jews, great scholars, who nevertheless felt that the Sabbatean Kabbalah had some validity to it. And that caused tremendous battles among rabbis. The greatest battle among the rabbis was the battle in the mid-8th to 1700s between Rabbi Yonis and Eibshitz and Rabbi Yaakov Emden. Rabbi Yonis and Eibshitz was a rabbi in various different places, and Rabbi Yaakov Emden was also rabbi in various different places. Ultimately, they both lived in the same community, which was Altoona in Germany. And Rabbi Yaakov Emden accused Rabbi Yonis and Eibshitz of being a closet Sabbatean, and that was how he wrote his annulus. Now, we know for a fact that Rabbi Yonis and Eibshitz's son was a known and definite Sabbatean. He wrote Sabbatean Kabbalistic works. I've actually seen them. They had the original manuscript in Skokie Yeshiva, where I learned for many years. That's still there.
Which
Yeshiva? Skokie, Theological College. I'm Carpenter Road.
I'm from there.
Yeah.
Wondering.
So you're also there, right? From the general area. So the, an even colder place.
Yeah.
They have the manuscript there, and it is basically an erotic work. It really is an incredibly sexually based work of Kabbalah, the Kabbalistic concept. So obviously there was smoke, and Rabbi Yaakov Emden accused Rabbi Yonis and Eibshitz of being a Sabbatean, and Rabbi Yonis and Eibshitz stoutly denied the charges. And this caused a tremendous rift among Jewry in Europe, because everybody lined up on different sides. And some people lined up on Rabbi Yonis' side, some people lined up on Rabbi Yaakov Emden's side. One of the great scholars of the time, perhaps besides the Vilna Gaon, the greatest scholar of the time, was the noted Yehuda, Reb Yecheskel Landau, who was the rabbi of Prague in the mid-1700s, who was the foremost potentate, decider of the authority of Jewish law of the time. And the noted Yehuda sided with the Bialis and Eichitz. So the whole question was if he sided with him sincerely or sided with him because he wanted to eliminate the controversy. But the members of the community of Frankfurt am Main in Germany sided with Rabbi Yaakov Emden. And therefore they accepted upon themselves an enactment, which is that no descendant of the Noda Yehuda had ever served in the rabbinate of the Frankfurt am Main. It was such a powerful risk that just siding with one side or the other could doom you with the other side. Eventually, everybody involved died. There's a very interesting, in the Altoona Cemetery, actually, Rabbi Yonatan Eichitz and Rabbi Yaakov Emden are buried very close to each other. And there's a legend which says that as Rabbi Yaakov Emden was dying 12 years after Rabbi Yonatan Eichitz died, he said, as his last words, "Welcome, Rabbi Yonatan." So it was that Rabbi Yonatan Eichitz came to accompany him to the world of truth. Now, I don't know if the story is true or not true, but it's a cool story. Yeah. And for much of the 18th century, there were trading charges back and forth, Sabbatane, not Sabbatane, counter-Sabbatane, pro-Sabbatane, and again, this was not the people who were involved in all sorts of that lens of licentious behavior. These were mainstream and great rabbis who were involved in these controversies. Obviously, this had the masses in a bind, because who can you trust? If this rabbi says that rabbi is a heretic, and that rabbi says this rabbi is a heretic, what are you supposed to do? Who are you supposed to believe? You have no way of knowing who's telling the truth. Certainly, you don't know about the Kabbalah involved. You have no clue, actually, what's going on. Which 99% of the population, obviously, was in that category. So this was really an action. It was, rabbinic authority was in tatters. And this also led for there to be an opening for the Hasidic movement to come out and spread like wildfire. Now, what the Hasidic movement, as I said, began with Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov, also called the Besht, which is an acronym for Baal Shem Tov, also called in earlier times the Rivash, which is an acronym for Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem. So Baal Shem Tov, or Besht, was a simple Jew who came from the Carpathian Mountains, and began life as a teacher's aide in a school, and as other odd jobs as a shamish, a sexton in a shul, in a synagogue. And he, according to legend, became a member of a secret society, which was the secret society which maintained the Kabbalistic traditions going all the way back to the time of the Talmud. And ostensibly, he learned his Torah of his mystical Torah from a mysterious figure named Rabbi Adam. Now Adam, not modern times withstanding, is not a traditional Jewish name. And they all, Adam's like in the 20th century you find Jews named Adam, right? And back in the 1600s they didn't have too many Adams. Wasn't a popular Jewish name, so it's kind of like mysterious, Reb Adam. Who ever heard of somebody named Adam back then? But nevertheless, there is such a tradition, and that he received this secret Torah from Reb Adam, and he made a deliberate decision, whether guided by heaven or on his own volition, to reveal this Torah. It was to take the esoteric part of Torah and reveal it. In other words, forget about the 40 years old. We're going to use Kabbalah as a positive tool. Now, I want to make this is a very important difference between classic Kabbalah and actually several differences between classic Kabbalah and Hasidic Kabbalah. I, for instance, like Hasidic Kabbalah very much. I find classic Kabbalah very dry and boring. What's the difference? It's the same concept, but Hasidus does not study Kabbalistic concepts as an end in and of itself. They use Kabbalistic concepts for inspirational purposes and to understand the simple text in a new way. If you have a classic Kabbalistic text, it is very dense. It's basically like memorizing mathematical formulae. It's a lot, this impacts on that, and that impacts on this, and this name does this, and that name does that, and unless you have the mind of an accountant or an actuary, you're going to be bored. So so what the Hasidim do is they don't have a systematic approach, but they use Kabbalistic concepts in order to inspire and create an emotional sense of holiness. And that, I think, to me, is much more rewarding, much more powerful. And that's basically what Rabbi Tov Baal Shem did. What Baal Shem Tov did is he took the emotional part of Torah, and he said to the Jews of the time, you don't have to be a great scholar to connect to God. You can be a simple person, and you can be more connected to the God than the greatest scholar. And there are two Hasidic stories which are variations on the same theme. They might be the same story, just with different details, which the Hasidim used to manifest this concept. It's the little boy who comes into shul on Rosh Hashanah, on Yom Kippur, and he doesn't know how to read, he never was taught in school, and he was an orphan, and he comes in one version, he comes in with his whistle, his shepherd's whistle, starts whistling. Another version, he comes in and takes the matzah, takes the prayer book, opens up and says, God, I don't know how to read, you take the letters. And does anybody know who knows the story? Who's heard the story? That's it. Oh boy, you guys are not Hasidic at all. So he
That's why we're here.
Okay.
So,
So he takes the rest of the congregation gets all upset, takes even the whistle, you know, that here is, they're trying to dive in with great intensity and great understanding, and here comes this kid with his whistle and starts whistling in the middle of the shul, but a brazen act, or he's ignoramus, and he just puts out his master and thinks God is going to answer him that way. And the way the story goes is that the Baal Shem Tov says to the congregation, he says, you should know there was a very heavy decree which was intended to befall the Jews this year, because of this little kid with his whistle, or because this little kid with his opening the book and showing it to God, that's why in heaven they know that evil decree. So that's a very powerful message in the story. The rest of the story is the Baal Shem Tov was davening in that shul. There were probably other great scholars davening in that shul. They didn't count. The person who counted was the person who came with true sincerity to God and made a true, sincere, even if not quite proper, because now it's whistle on holiday, right? Now if you use a whistle, you're out to whistle. Now if you use a whistle on a holiday, so if even not quite exactly proper, that act was the act which counted before God. So that was one of the major statements of early Hasidus, that you don't have to be a great scholar. A person with his pristine, simple, undeveloped, uncomplicated sense of connection to God can accomplish more than the great learned scholar. By the way, there's precedent for this in the Gemara. The Gemara says that there was a great sage named Rabbi Yochum ben Zakkai. Rabbi Yochum ben Zakkai was a leader of the generation, the Nasi, the leader of the Jewish people in the land of Israel. And there was another sage in the at the same time, Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa. Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa was not a halachic expert as far as we know. I don't think there are any halachic statements. There are very few quoted from him in the Talmud. But he was known as the greatest tzaddik, the most righteous person of the generation. So there are many stories about him. The classic story is that, one of the classic stories is that he was, there was a certain town in which there was a snake which was biting people and killing them, and he didn't know what to do, and Rabbi Chaim ben Dosa came and he put his leg out by the snake's hole, and everybody thought he was crazy, and the snake came out and bit him, and the snake died. And the Gemara says, woe to a person who is bitten by a snake, but woe to the snake who bites on the Chanina Mendoza. So said to the people, he said, you see, it's not sin, it's not the snake which kills, it's the sin which kills. Anyway, so when Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai had a person who was sick at home, he used to send Rabbi Chanina Mendoza should daven for him, for that sick person. And his wife asked Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai, what, is he greater than you? You're the leader of the Jewish people, how can he be greater than you? So he said, Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai said, no, he's not greater than me. But I'll give you an analogy. It's like a king who has a minister and a servant. Who has greater authority and power? The minister. But who gets to see the king much more often? The servant. So I'm like the minister, Rabbi Chanina Mendoza is like the servant. That's why he can go in and do things which I cannot do. So again, the idea being, if you are close to God, even if you're not a great, high, and mighty person, then you can accomplish tremendous things in this world. For yourself, for the Jewish people, etc. And this obviously was a very popular idea. Also, the Baal Shem Tov advocated happiness. Litvaks, Misnagdim, are traditionally morose, depressed people. That's their happiness. They like being morose and depressed. They thrive on that. So they, but Hasidim, the original Hasidim were very exuberant, spontaneous type of breed. And they would engage in lots of singing and dancing. And, you know, it's kind of like the, it's kind of as if you went to the Puritans in New England and started dancing and singing. They wouldn't like that very much. So if you went into Lithuania and started singing and dancing, you get a similar reaction. So there was antipathy towards that. But again, that was very popular with the common people. And they downgraded the value of asceticism. Until the time of the Baal Shem Tov was considered, if you want to be holy, you were an ascetic. You fasted a lot. You slept on the ground. You refrained from rolling in the snow. And there's all sorts of things which were opposed to the pleasures of the body. The Baal Shem Tov held that that's not necessary. You don't have to fast. You don't have to roll in the snow. If you're just happy and think about God and that's why you're happy, that's all you need to do. Yeah?
What's the idea of rolling in the snow?
Afflicting oneself.
Doing what?
Did you ever try rolling naked in the snow?
No.
It probably hurts. I don't know. I haven't tried it myself. But it's considered to be a form of self-flagellation.
Okay.
In other words, you're a wicked person, you surely deserve a punishment, right? So you should roll you in the snow. If you don't think you need a punishment, for sure we have to roll you in the snow.
Where did these ideas come from? Beyond this, this is like, you know, I'm not holy. I'm asking because it is in Christian thought that they do this. So I'm just wondering, did they just grow these ideas from Christian thought, or did they get it from somewhere?
It comes from the Gemara. The thing is that the Hasidim were so successful in revolutionizing Judaism that it comes to be an assumed that that kind of self-affliction and aesthetic behavior is non-Jewish type of behavior. It's not. There was always that strain of thought within Jewish thought, and I would say that until the time of Chassidim, it was the predominant strain, not the only strain, but the predominant strain was, if you want to be holy, that's every Monday and Thursday. Right? The Vilna Gaon's wife, she wanted to fast from Shabbat to Shabbat. The Vilna Gaon's wife told her she can't do it because she had to eat Malacha Malka. She has to eat after Shabbat and Yom. But other than that, that was the way they required the holiness, you know, denying themselves, not having, you know.
Is that where the Pentecostal came from?
I assume it comes from this pre-existing Jewish tradition. I mean, you know, you had the extreme cases at the time of the temple, the Essenes who went up into the desert, right, the ones who wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls, and lived lives of extreme deprivation, right? So, yeah, that was extreme. But that tradition is a very ancient Jewish tradition. Yeah.
I think it's probably what I was going to say.
I have another question. If you're going to get that disco, from what I understand, that's the community in Qumran wrote it, right? Were those people, they were a separate community from the ones in the temple, were they? Or were they, so did they live in Qumran because they didn't want to be part of the of the Judaic dynasty, they were holy or something?
No, they felt that the Jews in Jerusalem were not holy enough.
So they opposed the mainstream Judaism, right?
But they're extreme, but they took ideas which exist in Judaism of refraining from pleasures and luxuries and indulgences and took them to an extreme in their zealousness. But they didn't come out of nowhere.
Is there any credibility to their philosophy? Like, is it worth even thinking they might have been right in what they were and what they did to themselves?
See, I'm a big believer. I have a colleague with Orthomath is my third job. So in my first job, I have a colleague with which I have a very frequent philosophical disputes. And whenever I dispute this, you can go to my website and you can listen to a bunch of our debates. So one of the has anybody ever listened to the debate so long? Follow the link from rygb.blogspot.com. You remember that? Go to rygb.org. RYGB, that's my initials.
Red, yellow, green, blue.
Yeah, red, yellow, green, blue. That works. So the question is, how do we read history? So my view, which is of course not my view, but it's rather a view which I am correct, is that one learns from history God's will. Now, you might not be able to tell God's will within a short span of time, say a year, 2 years, 10 years, 20 years. But if you look over a span of hundreds and thousands of years, then you can tell what God's will is. And it certainly seems that God's will was that the Essenes should be extinct. So I would assume that that's the case, that God did not like their philosophy and did not hold that it was one that should be emulated.
Well, they didn't get married. Did they get married?
No, they didn't get married, which might have contributed to the problem as well. Yeah.
Shouldn't the Russians have joined like a secret society? Isn't it like a Jewish secret society?
Yes.
Who was like his writing?
What?
Did he ever write who was his
writing? Reb Adam.
Yes, but someone a little more known.
No.
What about Shaloni? Isn't it someone Shaloni?
Achia Shaloni is a prophet who came down and thought about Hashem. It wasn't saying Rebbe.
Oh, okay.
Another thing about Shem Tov did is he was relatively lenient in halachic standards. Now that's important because today Hasidim are much more stringent in halachic standards than Hasidim are stringent. Hasidim seem to be more stringent in halachic standards, but that's not true. They're stringent in the way they dress, but in halachic Hasidic poskim, rabbis are traditionally more lenient than non-Hasidim.
Well,
after
when
the whole
chicken guess what happened, that the
Diana
was
prophesying
much more stringently than.
Right, there's certain things, but like when it comes to legal questions, there are other things. But again, but things change over time. And then, for example, the concept of having an Eruv in a town didn't exist before the Baal Shem Tov came along. And the Litvaks were always opposed to it. Baal Shem Tov is one who promoted having Eruv in all over, so people should have more pleasant Shabbos. You should be able to carry stuff on Shabbos back and forth to wherever they have to go. So that was very, it's a Hasidic innovation. That's just one example. There are many other things which the Hasidim innovated, but even hot mikveh. So the time of the Hasidim, you want to go to the mikveh? Cold mikveh. The heating mikveh is considered to be scandalous. So, you know, you had to actually, what they did is they put like boards at the bottom of a well, or put boards in the river bank, you know, and you had to go and break the ice in the middle of the winter if you wanted to go to the mikveh. So people were hardier back then. So the Baal Shem Tov, he and his followers instituted the concept of a warm mikveh. A great leap forward. Yeah.
Does warmth make it absorb the tumor? Or
what?
Does warmth have it? It could absorb tumor if it's something's warm? Or
no? No, that's not because of that. Because if it's warm, it's as if it looks as if it was. People might misconstrue that it was drawn in a bucket and then warmed up. Right? Because how else do you warm up a mikveh? What actually they did is they poured hot water into the well. So that way, and you know, that way the water, the hot water sat on top of the cold water. But there is this issue that it looks like you're using
water which is heated in a barrel or something, and that you can't use for a mixer.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, and I have to stop here for tonight. So in the coming weeks, we'll get more into the 1700s, and so for those of you who are just tonight, thank you for coming. You're going to be here for the last?
Tomorrow.
Okay. Enjoy the rest of your stay.
I'm not sure you have